Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with Watergate prosecutor and host of hashtag sisters-in-law, Jill Wine Banks, and I'm Al Hunt. James Carville will be back next episode. This week, our guest is the Dean of the Paul Nitze School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins and the former Deputy Secretary of State, Jim Steinberg. Now, remember, we love taking your questions. So write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Please check out the link to our sponsor, Miracle Made, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting our sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. So please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Hey, Jill, it's such a pleasure to have you on elevating this podcast. Let's do a little preview of Thursday night's debate and what to look for. Let me start with 2 points. I think what matters is the overall impression. It's not scored like a boxing match, and I'm skeptical of instant polls. And two, I think you're going to look, both are going to try to get under the other's skin. And it's essential that Joe Biden not go for the bait when Trump makes wild insults about his family or something. What are your thoughts going into Thursday night?
So I agree, Al, with everything that you said. I would say that although the overall impression is what should matter, when somebody scores a real zinger, it gets press headlines.
It does.
So part of what I'm concerned about is how the press covers this. There was just an article that showed that it's not my imagination that they, like, by 7 or 8 times cover more about the mental acuity of Biden than they do about Trump, even though Trump is as bad or worse in terms of errors, and also in terms of crazy, just getting out of control stuff. So the overall impression will be, is it amazing if Trump stays calm and actually answers questions? I think it's highly unlikely. So I don't think he will do that, but I think you're right. We'll be looking for that. I think we, hopefully should be looking forward to some discussion of issues. You know, the differences between immigration, economy, you know, with Biden fostering a discussion about jobs, which have increased dramatically, and salaries that have increased, whereas Trump will just talk prices and the fact that you get less for your money now. And Biden has to be prepared to tell why that has nothing to do with him.
Let's get into some of those issues in just a minute. But first, I mean, you are an incredibly distinguished lawyer and have been for a long time. I first saw you during Watergate. I didn't get to meet you, but I was dazzled by you. I remember just thinking, my gosh, this is what a great woman lawyer looks like. This is what a great lawyer looks like. And you sure were. But this is different than a legal argument tonight, isn't it?
Very different. Because, although I would say in both cases, in a trial and in a debate, facts matter. But delivery may matter more in a debate. And so you have this combination of there'll be fact-checking, and we can expect that Trump, as always, will not stick to the truth. He has more Pinocchios than anyone else I know awarded for fact-checking not being accurate. But I think delivery does matter. It does in front of a jury, but ultimately they really pay attention to the facts. And I've never been a flashy lawyer. I've always built on the facts and just organized them in a way that leads you inevitably to the conclusion I want you to reach. And I think that Biden can do exactly that.
Yeah, I hope so. I think Trump already is trying to intimidate the umpires, work the umpires. That's what he always, that's what a lot of people do, as a matter of fact. I think Jake Tapper and Dana Bash are two professionals, and they're going to be okay on that. Most of the questions are predictable, as in every debate, and including one or two on abortion. Here's one, however, I hope they will ask Trump. Simply, as a Florida resident, how are you going to vote on that state referendum that would basically codify Roe in Florida? The only alternative is the current 6-week ban. This is returning to the issues to the state, which is preferable, Mr. former president? I don't think he'll like that question.
He will answer it as, my vote is a secret thing and I'm not going to share it with you. That's how he will evade, as he often does, answering specific questions.
And I think if he does, he'll get hammered for weeks on that. How are you going to vote? I mean, because the fact of the matter is he doesn't care about abortion, never has cared about abortion. It's just a useful vehicle for him. And now, since the Dobbs decision, in 2016, I think abortion slightly helped Trump as a political issue, and maybe he was pretty neutral in 20. Now it's an issue that completely favors the Democrats and favors Biden if he handles it well.
The problem with abortion as an issue is that polling shows that it is low on the list of things people will vote on. In terms of their opinion, they 100% agree with the Democrats and disagree with the Republicans. But they will vote on the economy and other issues before they will make that the decisive factor. It should motivate a lot of people to vote who might not otherwise vote. So I think it will have an impact. And what they're doing now with both IVF and contraception and transgender treatment will also impact and will make huge swaths of groups say, I cannot vote for the Republicans because it impacts me personally.
Yeah, I agree. I think abortion always ranks, as you say, fifth, sixth, or seventh. But yet in some tests, whether it's a special election in New York for Congress or a state election in Alabama, pollsters like Jim Gerstein tell me it brings out more voters than you think. It is one of those issues where people will say it's, yes, the fifth most important. But for instance, in that New York special election, he thought they'd win. He was the pollster for the Democrat. He thought they'd win by 3 or 4. They won by 7 or 8. And he said the reason was abortion brought out more women than we thought.
I hope that that is true. It should. And it should bring out men as well, because men are affected. They are the fathers of those potential births. And if they don't want to be a father at that particular time, or for whatever their reason, they have to be concerned about whether their rights are taken away as much as the women do.
No, they sure do. What other issues are you looking for tonight, Jill?
I said immigration, the economy, abortion. I think SCOTUS should be an issue because we've seen what happened because Donald Trump made 3 really conservative appointments. And, the predictions are that if he won another term, he could convince at least Thomas to retire, and he would be able to appoint a young Thomas, someone with his same viewpoints, but who could be on the court for another 40 years as opposed to Thomas. I also think some foreign policy issues may play into this. Obviously, the Gaza-Israel situation has become very contentious. And the interesting thing is, I don't know that you'll get a difference between the two of them. So that might help in a way because people are blaming Biden for his support of Israel. But obviously, Donald Trump is a huge supporter of Israel. So that could be an issue. And I think, Biden has a chance to show some of the minority voters, Black voters, Latino voters, LGBTQ plus voters, young voters, why they should support him. He does have that opportunity on Thursday, and I hope that he will take it. Labor could be an issue because Donald Trump is trying to, portray himself as favorable to labor, which of course is absolutely not true. That doesn't stop him from making the claim, but hopefully he can be rebutted on that.
Yeah, that's why I think actually I'm not as optimistic about Gaza being a draw, because I think Donald Trump will lie. He'll say, never would have been a war if I had been president. I'm the strong man. I can settle Ukraine, Russia in 24 hours. Of course, that's utter, complete nonsense. Yeah. And the question is, I'm not totally sure of the format. As I said earlier, I think these are pretty darn good moderators. And I hope there's some follow-up to some fact-checking to capture either candidate, but it's going to happen far more with Trump when they tell out-and-out lies.
Well, the good part of the format is that the mics will be muted when the candidate is not the speaker. And so that Trump cannot, as he did in the last time they debated, interrupt repeatedly and numerous times to the point where Biden actually had to said, shut up, man. And he was right. I mean, he was right. But this way, it can't happen. He gets his time to answer and Biden gets his time to answer and neither can interrupt the other. So that encourages me. I hope that they are both prepared because that would be the way that you have a debate where you really do answer the questions that are asked. Although in a debate, as in anything, when you answer questions, you sometimes veer to answering the question you wanted to be asked right on the subject rather than the one that you are actually asked. And so, you know, I as we were talking about with Trump claiming success on certain things and, you know, it's all me, he can veer to answering what he wished he had been asked rather than how did you vote or how would you vote. He doesn't have to answer that. He'll talk about what free elections mean and why he doesn't have to answer. And so I'm sure they're both prepared to some extent, although we see no evidence that Donald Trump is actually looking at policy and preparing in the same way that Biden is preparing.
Jill, at 8 p.m. Central Time, Thursday evening, how nervous are you going to be?
I guess I have to admit that I will be nervous because Donald Trump is an unpredictable person who could just go berserk. I personally guess I hope he does because that's who he is. And I think, you know, for example, MSNBC is no longer covering his rallies, but that means we don't always see how crazy he is. Misplaced, but I was going to wear one of my hashtag Jill's pins. I recently acquired a shark because to me that symbolizes his lunacy where he's debating, would I rather get eaten by a shark or electrocuted in an electric boat? I'll take the electrocution, all the, get me away from that shark. That's insane. Had nothing to do with what the subject was. He just rambles on to that. So I have to find my shark pin before I leave the house today for sure.
I want you to promise you're going to wear that shark pin Thursday night.
Oh, I will. I will. Absolutely.
All right, everybody. Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 8 Central Time. It will be a really important hour and a half. Hey, Jim, welcome. And as America awaits tonight's Biden-Trump debate, the geopolitical crises around the world are not standing still. As a top State Department diplomat, prominent scholar, you are versed in all these. Let's start with the Middle East. What are the dangers of a wider war, Hezbollah in the north, Hamas diminished but not destroyed, threat to Israel, and the Houthis endangering commercial sea lanes? While Israel and Iran both, I read, may not want a bigger war, it's a tinderbox full of possible miscalculations. How do you assess the risk?
I think the risk is very high. I think we're in a very, very dangerous situation because, although, as you said, I think that everybody understands the downsides to escalation at this point, there's also a sense that nobody can afford to back down, and particularly with the ongoing stalemate in Gaza. And the difficulty of reaching any kind of stable solution, the pressures, particularly on the northern border, are extremely high. The escalations in recent days have been very, very serious. And there is a limited ability of each side to take the steps that would be necessary to calm this down. So I think particularly across the northern border, the danger of an escalation is high. We've heard reports from Israel that that demand for personnel is declining in Gaza. There's an intention to shift forces up to the north, and the situation there is not stable. Too many Israelis have been displaced. The Israelis feel the need to respond, and so I think the risk of escalation is extremely high.
Jim, some of us, we might be called cynics, I think we're skeptics, think that Benjamin Netanyahu does not want to have some kind of an accord because that could threaten his coalition and focus back on the worst intelligence failure in the history of the state of Israel on October the 7th. How do you assess Netanyahu's desires and policies right now?
You know, I'm always very reluctant to attribute those kinds of motives. I think it's certainly possibly true, but because there's an alternative narrative, which Bibi Netanyahu is very committed to, even without his legal difficulties, it's quite possible that he would be pursuing the course that he's been pursuing. He has, we've seen over the 30 years that I've been dealing with him, that he fundamentally does not believe that a two-state solution is in Israel's interest or sustainable. And so even if he didn't have his own legal difficulties and his own political challenges, I'm not sure that he would agree to this. And I think he has a lot of sympathy with the more right-wing members of his coalition that basically thinks that there's no arrangement that would be satisfactory for Israel's security. And I think that's unfortunate because I think that's extremely dangerous diagnosis. But so whether or not he also has political motives, I have a feeling that, this is pretty deeply ingrained in his view of the world.
Well, he was handed a new problem earlier this week by the Israeli Supreme Court, which ruled that the government must start drafting Orthodox, young Orthodox men who have been exempt, I guess men and women, who have been exempt so far. And that those right-wing religious groups are central to his coalition now. I don't know how he's going to handle that, but give I think the Israelis may be among the most admirable people in the world who have one of the very worst democratic systems in the world. But this is a problem if that carries through, Jim.
It's a problem, but I mean it is a democratic system, and that's part of our difficulty here is that. Despite, I think, the discomfort that Netanyahu's policies cause many, including friends of Israel, they have the system that they've adopted, and the opposition has not been able to rally sufficient support to take power. You know, I think many of us would like to see the opposition take on Netanyahu at this point and really try to redirect the direction. But that's part of the challenge for any American president in dealing with the situation there is we tend to accept the idea that we have to deal with democratic governments as they are constituted. And for better or for worse, this is the one that we have to deal with in Israel. And it's certainly not going to get any better with the breakdown of the war cabinet and Netanyahu's increasing dependence on his far extreme right.
Well, you're absolutely right. But that doesn't prevent us from conditioning some aid. I mean, if you have an Israeli prime minister who just rejects anything a president says, actually sometimes insults him, he's going to come here July 25th to address a joint session. And I'm sure he's going to take, or I suspect he'll take shots at Biden. I mean, why can't the administration justifiably impose some conditions on assistance?
Well, I mean, the administration has imposed some conditions because it has limited certain kinds of military aid that it's providing Israel. But it also, I mean, you have to ask yourself the question, what is the goal? If the goal is simply to make a statement, there's an argument for that. If the goal is to make a difference in terms of Israeli behavior, we have to think about what the impact is. Would withholding the aid actually lead to the results that that the administration would like to see? And to some extent, we have to recognize that even though there are many aspects of Netanyahu's policies that clearly the Biden administration disagrees with, he also has a lot of support for many of those policies within Israel itself. And one of the lessons I learned from President Clinton and working with him many years is that you have to be conscious of the fact about not only how is your policy or the measures you want to take going to affect the government, but how is this going to affect the broader people? And will this affect the overall degree of trust and support that Israelis have in the United States? Mm-hmm. So the administration is walking a fine line here. And I think what it wants to do is, on the one hand, demonstrate that it is sympathetic with the big challenge that Israel faces. After all, Hamas has not stood down. Hamas has not sort of said, okay, we get it now. We're not going to continue this. Quite the opposite. So, you know, the fundamental need to deal with Hamas problem is something the administration is sympathetic with. And so it is walking a fine line in terms of both making a statement about the principles that we believe in, but also try to figure out what's the most effective way to move the policy.
Jim, let's turn to Ukraine. There was a sense a month or so ago the Russians were on the offense, that the situation might even be precarious. With the arrival of American weapons, which House Republicans shamefully delayed for months, is the tide turning back?
You know, it's always very difficult to tell in these situations. And I'm an experienced diplomat, but I'm not a former general. And so I'm always very cautious in my own assessments of the battlefield thing. I think there are two separate ways of thinking about this. One is what, you know, the military types would call the force-on-force thing, and looking at, you know, what it will take given the progress that the Russians were able to make in digging in and developing these really remarkable defenses they now have in terms of the operational ability of Ukraine to dislodge them. But there's a deeper game, and that's the question about sort of what the long term is here. And I think that's the big problem now for the Ukrainians, because they have to demonstrate to the Russians that they can not just fight today and tomorrow, but can fight indefinitely, and that this is something that both they have the capacity and the will to do, and their supporters have the long-term determination. Because what I fear is that Putin continues to believe that he can wait the Ukrainians out, and that that time is on his side. And so the challenge for all of us, and it's very relevant to the American political scene, is to demonstrate, as President Biden has sought to do, which is to say that we're in for this as long as Putin's in for this, and that we will stick with Ukraine, even though there may not be a short-term resolution to this problem.
I think that's a very credible argument by President Biden. However, I think Putin is waiting and hoping for a Trump victory in November, which would change those dynamics. What would those consequences be for Ukraine and for Europe?
You know, I mean, I obviously, at the end of the day, if Trump is elected, he is free to make whatever decisions he proposes to make. But I certainly would hope, despite his past track record, that he would understand how profound the consequences are, not just for Ukraine, but for the United States. I mean, I think the consequences of the United States of walking away from this, particularly given how really impressive the European effort has been in turn, not only is going to be determinative for the fate of the brave and courageous Ukrainian people, but for the long-term relationship with Europe. You know, I've just spent a week and a half in Europe talking with a lot of senior officials throughout Europe and analysts there, and they really see this as a decisive moment in transatlantic relations. I think the good news about Ukraine is it has brought us back together in common purpose. But if a Trump administration came in and tried to cut a deal with Putin, I think this would cause Europeans to think very profoundly about, you know, how much it was worth continuing to work with the United States, not just on this issue, but on a whole host of issues, not just in Europe, but around the world.
Yeah. Switching the subject again, Graham Allison and Mike Morrell, two sober-minded adults with government experience, wrote a piece for Foreign Affairs that said the terrorist alarm bells are ringing, similar to the period before 9/11. If so, do you think we're prepared this time?
You know, the problem, as always with these things, is that the terrorists only have to be successful and lucky once, and we have to be successful and lucky all the time.
Yeah.
And so one can never, ever, no matter how much effort, how much creativity, how many resources that we put into, and we feel complacent that we are going to be able to stop terror in all places at all times. I think we've, you know, dramatically improved our capabilities across a full range of things. But, you know, there are still concerns about resiliency of some of our systems, concerns about, you know, whether we are prepared not just to stop in every case, which we can't be confident of, but to really make sure that the consequences of a terrorist action won't affect us. I think part of it, too, and I think the service that Graham and Mike's piece does is to remind people that we can't be complacent about this. The fact that we have been so successful for two decades doesn't guarantee that we will continue to be in the future. So it's not at the top of mind with the crises in Europe, in the Middle East, in East Asia, but it is an ever-present threat that requires vigilance and focus by all concerned.
You mentioned East Asia. You have expertise in a lot of things. You have special expertise, you and Zeiss, in China. And your policy of strategic reassurance, which seemed sensible 10, 20 years ago, is it dead now with the aggressive, really anti-Americanism of Xi, who may be president for life?
You know, I mean, you say anti-Americanism, but this is, you know, that's not how it's seen in China. I mean, they think of this as anti-Chinism in the United States. And there's a lot to be blamed for Xi's policies, a lot of assertiveness that's uncomfortable for us. But China is a big power, and we have to deal with it. And it's not enough just to sort of say, well, we don't like what they're doing, and you know, so we're just going to push back on them. I think we have to recognize that China is going to insist on having a voice in international affairs, and we have to decide what we can allow them and what role we can allow them to play and what role would be completely unacceptable to us. Now, that begins with the fact that they cannot use force or the threats of force to coerce either us or our friends and neighbors, and we have to be very clear about that. But we also have to recognize that there are things that China believes that we do that are designed to harm and hurt them. So the point of this idea of strategic assurance is not just for us to reassure them, but for them to reassure us. So in the first instance, as the rising power, China has to demonstrate to its neighbors and to us and the rest of the world that just because it's bigger and more powerful and more technologically advanced, that it's not going to try to push people around. And we see a lot of that pushing around taking place in vis-a-vis Taiwan and the South China Sea. And so if China wants us to be responsive to its concerns, it's got to start by showing that it can be what our good friend Bob Zelik once called a responsible player. And so that's the reassurance that China needs to offer the rest of the world. And in return, I think we need to be prepared to say, if you're prepared to do that, then we're prepared to give you an appropriate seat at the table, given the size and consequence of China in the world.
Well, I hope that's the case. But one of this podcast's favorite guests and someone I suspect you respect, Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, the top Democrat on the House China Committee, said recently that our earlier engagement with China basically was a mistake.
Now, I just disagree with the congressman, and he and I have had a chance to talk about that for many, many years. I mean, first of all, you know, it's not obvious to me that if we had been more confrontational at an earlier stage, that things would have gone better, right? I mean, I think the sort of the notion that somehow if we had been tougher at an earlier stage, that China would have pursued a different path or would have been more willing to do what we said is not at all clear. I think that it was important to test the proposition and important to recognize that, you know, we had had a hostile policy towards China for the first 20 years after the communist revolution there, and that didn't prove very successful either.
It didn't.
So I think that it's just too easy to say because we don't like where we are now, that somehow if we had been tougher earlier, it would have come out better. Arguably, it could have come out worse. And by the way, none of our friends and allies at the time when we did that period of engagement in the 1990s and early 2000s would have supported us because all of them wanted to see constructive engagement with China too. There's no doubt that China, particularly under Xi, has taken a different turn, and we have to deal with that. And that has required us to take more forceful measures, which I support. But it's just too easy and too simple to kind of import that back to an earlier time and say, oh, that was all a terrible mistake.
Yeah. Final question. Robert O'Brien, who might well be slated for a top post in any Trump administration, talks to the former president. He wrote a piece advocating really for a much, much harsher policy against China, even calling at one point to send all U.S. Marines to Asia. Now, he backed down from that a little bit. But how do you envision U.S.-China relations in 2025 if A, Trump is president, or B, Biden is reelected? And what's the difference?
You know, I mean, I think in some ways, the playbook is not that difficult. I mean, we have to demonstrate to China that we will defend our interests, we will defend and support our allies, and that we have the capacity and the will to do that. And that primarily has nothing to do with sending Marines or anybody else to fight wars in Asia. It's to make sure that the United States is the most technologically advanced, economically powerful country with adequate military capabilities if it comes down to that. But part of the reason we got in trouble, in my view, in the early period under Xi is that people began to doubt whether the United States was going to remain competitive and engaged in the world. And I think to the credit of the Biden administration, they have done both, which is they have helped through a number of efforts to strengthen ourselves at home through technological innovation, through supporting our industrial and infrastructure base, but also to engaging and deepening our ties with our allies and to show that we're willing to be engaged in the world. And I think that was at issue when President Trump was president, because it was not clear to the Chinese or anybody else whether the United States under President Trump was prepared to do any of these things. So I think we are on a course, and we're seeing the response in China. We're seeing in the San Francisco summit and things that China now recognizes that the United States isn't going to go away, isn't going to just back down, isn't going to be weak and crumbling. And so that's what we need to do. If we focus on our own inherent strengths, China will see that we are a formidable adversary, and it will cause them to think twice about their own objectives. So I think that should be the priority, and not simply focus on, you know, hostile attitudes towards China and provoking a military confrontation.
Well, on that note, Jim Steinberg, thank you so much for being with us. It's always good to have a dean on the show, particularly the dean of a prestigious place like SAIS at Johns Hopkins. I'm a little bit jealous that you took over that marvelous building on Pennsylvania Avenue from the Freedom Forum, but you really were terrific today, and thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me, Al. It's always a real treat to be with you.
Terrific. Hey, now for the outrage of the week. We know how crazy these House Republicans are. We know how unprincipled most are, horrified by the make-believe Biden crimes while pretending Donald Trump, as in the convicted felon, is St. Francis of Assisi. But they also are really petty. Marjorie Taylor Greene, she of the one that talked about Jewish-like laser beams starting California forest fires, she's really unhappy with policies of the Defense Department, a subject about which she is even more ignorant than usual. So she is proposing, therefore, to punish Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin by cutting his salary to $1. I mean, that's just such a unserious proposition by such an unserious person. But everyone out there, just assess Green and Austin's character and capacity and come back and tell us which one you think should have their salary cut. Hey, now for our listener questions, which are always a highlight every week. Jill, the first is from Leanne in Oak Park, Illinois. She wants to know, how worried should we be about agitators, instigators, and protesters at the Chicago convention this summer? Dirty trickster Roger Stone will undoubtedly be trying to stir the pot. I also worry that far-left Palestinian supporters will cause problems. Is Chicago ready for this?
I believe they are. I've heard the plans from the mayor and from the police, and I think they're prepared. I wasn't in Chicago in 1968, which was an abysmal failure in terms of how the police and the mayor handled this. I think Chicago is ready, and I believe in the right of free speech. So I'm, you know, happy to see protests, but they will be organized not to interfere with entrance to the convention, travel to the convention, or inside the convention. So I think it's going to be handled much better. We have the experience of 1968 and learn from our mistakes. I feel confident that it's going to go smoothly.
Yeah, I'm hopeful, and I'm particularly hopeful if the Gaza situation has tamped down by then. But I can assure you, if anyone will be there to stir up the pot, it'll be the dirty trickster sleazebag of all times, Roger Stone. Yes. Our next question is from Arthur in Covington, Kentucky, and I'm actually going to combine that with one from Charles in Christchurch, New Zealand. We're really big down in New Zealand, I'll tell you. Arthur says, if Trump and other Republicans lose this election cycle, will we face a domestic threat from supporters? The answer to that, Arthur, is you betcha. He will not accept the outcome. I don't care if it's more convincing than last time. He's a man with no regard for truth. He knows that he has to be in office probably to stay out of jail.
And I don't think there is any way that Trump and his supporters will accept this. I know that the Biden team did a fantastic job last time. My dear friends Seth Waxman and the late Walter Dellinger and Don Verrilli won 60 cases. They are equally prepared this time. But Trump doesn't do anything gracefully. And the second question, and then, Jill, you join both, from our friend Dan in New Zealand. If Trump loses in November, could this be the demise of the GOP as we know it? No, it won't be the demise. The big question will be, if he loses, does the GOP then try to go back to its mainstream roots, or will Trumpism be the dominant part of the party even without Trump?
Hard to answer that second part in terms of what the Republican Party that we used to know, what was the grand old party, whether it will return to its real roots or whether it will stay a Trump party. It's hard to say. But if they lose, remember they lost, well, first of all, they lost even in 2016, they lost the popular vote. In 2020, they lost both the popular and the Electoral College vote. If they lose both again, they're going to have to rethink whether they can ever be a major national party. And so maybe they will go back to being the Republican Party of Reagan. I don't know how far back they'll go, but that might work. And in terms of everything else, yeah, I agree with you on everything you said.
Jill, our next question comes from Pat in Durham, North Carolina, who says, I've heard disengagement within the electorate is a major driver of several top political issues, including polarization. At the same time, the last presidential election showed a huge turnout. What gives? How do we start address falling engagement?
I think we have to lower the rhetoric so that we get back to some sense that you could have a civil conversation between Democrats and whatever you call the other side. I've tried to engage with Trump supporters, and I have to say I have not been successful because they refuse to accept facts. And if you don't agree on facts, if we go back to Watergate, all the networks had one set of facts. They debated the policy implications of those facts, but they didn't debate facts. They didn't create alternative facts. And unless we get back to a point where we can agree that there's a lower unemployment rate, there's a higher salary rate, those are facts. You have to accept that in order to debate what's the best way to keep that going. Is it trickle-down economics by keeping the rich from paying taxes? No, it isn't. We've seen repeatedly that when you raise the taxes on the middle class, lower them on the upper, it does not help the middle class. But as long as people are feeling as badly as they feel about the economy, you can't argue that we have to save democracy for people who feel democracy hasn't served them. So it's a matter of communicating individual facts to people as to how they are personally helped by different policies, and to find the one thing that maybe will make them see that they are hurt by the Donald Trump, I hate to even say Donald Trump policies, but maybe to talk about Project 2025 and what that would mean to every person in America, because that would be the end of any country we've ever known.
Well, I agree with you, and there are issues that you can talk about that directly affect, in addition to abortion, health care. The Affordable Health Care Act expires next year. Drug pricing, which people really care a lot about. And it's really important, I think, to drive those home. You know, going to Pat's question, and you know, we talked about that old Republican Party of Watergate, which had Howard Baker and Barry Goldwater and Bill Cohen. They don't exist today, though, Jill.
Yeah. That is true. That is true. And even Romney, who seemed to be more the old style Republican, he's leaving. He's I think today is the Utah primary and there'll be a new candidate. He's out.
Yeah. The next question comes from David in Smithfield, North Carolina. So should Biden have E.J. Carroll, Stormy Daniels, and Karen McDonald Dougal sitting in the front row the same way Trump did with Bill Clinton accusers with Hillary. No, he can't, because the rules are you can't have guests in there, and it would be a bad idea anyway. Besides, if he wanted to get all the people who have accused Trump of sexual indiscretion, I'm not sure you could, you know, have enough seats in the arena. There have been far more than these three. You're talking about at least 26, but that's not a good idea. And I think gimmicks, I think Joe Biden's not a gimmick person. So let's just go. I'm very pleased they're having a debate, Joe, without an audience.
Yeah, no audience, no props. And Trump is someone who does like to use props. I think those are good and healthy things. And I think it was a mistake for him to try to intimidate by bringing in people the last time. And I think it would be, you know, we don't want to lower ourselves to that level. And so I'm glad that they have those rules in place.
I just want to say to everybody out there, we're talking about debates, go back on YouTube and look at the Kennedy-Nixon debate of 1960. Yes. And just watch John F. Kennedy's opening eight-minute remarks. It was masterful. And that, you know, with that, it was different rules then. Each began with 8 minutes. With that 8 minutes, I think the election was basically over. I doubt we're going to find anything quite so conclusive Thursday night, but we will see. Joe, we have another Chicago. John says, if Trump gets elected, it's a terrible thought, and retaliates against Department of Justice employees like Jack Smith and other prosecutors with a lot of phony charges, do you think that'll stand up in a court of law up to this Supreme Court?
Well, that's the problem. This Supreme Court is completely unpredictable. And again, let me refer back to Project 2025, which is much more than using the Department of Justice to retaliate. It is eliminating the entire civil service and replacing everyone in government. I mean, they've only said, I think, 50,000, but I just heard one of the authors of Project 2025 saying, that's not enough. There are millions of civil servants, and we have to get rid of all of them and replace them with people who are loyal to Trump. That is terrifying. And the Supreme Court itself is terrifying because they could, for example, there's still a case pending about whether administrative agencies can continue to function. And if they don't, they're saying, well, Congress should be making these decisions. Congress can't make any decisions, but it certainly doesn't have time to make the kind of detailed analysis of issues that require a great deal of expertise. That's why we have administrative agencies, is to do that and to make regulations. So it would be terrifying. I mean, the whole prospect is, it's not acceptable.
Couldn't agree more. Our final question is from Jeff in St. Pete Beach, Florida, who asks, should Biden perform poorly at the debate? Do you all believe that he'll be willing to take the whole ship down with him? The Democrats will allow him to do this, or will it be someone else? Jeff, the train has left the station. Biden is not going to get out, whether he does well or not the other night. Some of us thought he shouldn't have run. A year ago, he has run. And the choice now is simply Biden or Trump. And the idea that there's going to be some magical way to have a different ticket or a different choice simply is not reality. Joe, you don't disagree, do you?
No, I completely agree with what you said. I personally think he's been a terrific president. I think he's accomplished more in one term than most accomplish in two. And the other thing that I would note is his cabinet and his top advisors, you know, sub-cabinet level, are really fantastic people. And they will keep the government going. They are what's important. If you elect Donald Trump, you're electing a convicted felon, still awaiting multiple trials, a convicted civil violator of not just sexual assault, but defamation and fraud. And look at who his people are. And in the first term, he did have some people who said, no, you can't do that. He will not make that happen again. He will have only people who will do his bidding. And so there will be no guardrails.
Yes,
if
you're right.
Either of them dies in office, wouldn't you rather have the cabinet and the top people that are selected by Biden rather than the ones who will be selected by Donald Trump, I would certainly rather have the government that Biden creates as the legacy, as opposed to anything that Donald Trump will put into place.
Well, you're absolutely right. And Jeff and others out there, it's a very simple choice in November. It's Biden or Trump. There's no third way. We have been so fortunate to have Jill Winebanks on as a co-host today. And you can see why I was so dazzled 50 years ago. We haven't aged 50 years, have we, Jill?
Not me.
No,
not
of course
you.
Not.
For sure not. I cannot believe that at all.
Anyway, you were just terrific. Thank you. And we'll keep our fingers crossed Thursday night.
Thanks, Al. Let's talk on Thursday night after we hear the debate.
Good idea.
I think it's going to go well. I'm optimistic that Donald Trump will show his true colors and the character of Joe Biden will come through.
On that note, we again will thank you so much, and we will talk right afterwards, okay? Take care, Jill.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with Jill Winebanks, and I'm Al Hunt. James Carville's going to be back next week, so start thinking of what to ask him. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the link to our sponsor, Miracle Made, in our episode show notes. We deeply thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go and take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.